of it. So we're here to step into the resurrection story. That's what we've been doing since Palm Sunday. So you are stepping in into chapter 4 of a sermon that started on Sunday and then continued on Maundy, Thursday, and on Good Friday, and we'll conclude today. And we've been looking at four kind of understandings of what is new life. We talk about new life a lot. A lot of churches named after new life, stuff like that. But what does it actually mean? And the first thing that we saw that it meant on Palm Sunday is it means that sin is forgiven. Jesus literally offers himself for sin. Secondly, we saw on Maundy, Thursday, that shame is silence. Had a powerful night in here for that. And in the third chapter, we saw that distance is erased. Scott and Mike Trapiano came and dropped a banger, and we saw that, and it was incredible. So today we're here to look at resurrection. So in the text, there's two resurrections that take place. One is a literal resurrection, and it's of Jesus Christ, literally resurrected from the grave. But Mary experiences a resurrection herself, a resurrection of a person that a culture would ultimately have given up on. And I stand before you today, compelled to bring this message because I have experienced a resurrection. What the Lord has done in my life is why I stand before you. It's not what I've read and what I've studied and what I was convinced of. It was who found me and how he found me. And I think that all of us will go along a similar path, though each of our destinations is the same. Our journey to that place is pretty unique. And everyone in here, and I know I haven't had the privilege of meeting most of you, I would prefer my first meeting interaction with you to be over coffee or something like that, but this is probably how I'm meeting most of you for the first time, and I want to say it's an honor to be here, and I want to make this abundantly clear. The only reason I'm standing here today is because Jesus is alive. It's not my seminary degree. I didn't go to seminary. That let you down. I'm going to remove all doubt here in a second. So we're going to move on a path here. The path we're going through is from the garden to the grave, from the grave to the gathering, from the gathering to the grave again, and then back to the garden. So if you grew up Baptist, you'll love that all five started with G's. And if you grew up charismatic, you'll love that there's 5 points and not three. So we're going to go on this journey together because though I believe your story is unique and our church would love to hear your story, we're going to follow a similar path, and we're going to follow along with some questions, some difficulties, and some marvelous answers. So, one more time, just to get it out of your system. Christ is risen. To the garden. So the story of Scripture and the story today starts in a garden. Jesus is buried in a garden. But the story that precedes this story is in another garden, and that garden is named Eden. Eden is a unique garden because everything is perfect there. So what do we mean by perfect? Here's a few categories for you. Eden, people are unashamed, creation is unstained, and relationship with God is unhindered. This is how God intended for creation to exist. Unashamed, unstained, and unhindered. So the ancient Hebrew imagination would have called this shalom. Say shalom. There you go. You're speaking another language now. It's getting crazy in here already. So, and this understanding of shalom is peace. Now, peace in the biblical understanding is not just there's no war. It's the idea of completion. So something is at peace when it's completely complete is one way to understand it. So in Eden, when it says that things are very good, that means it's at peace, shalom, everything is well. And what marks that wellness? Unashamed, unstained, unhindered. But there's something lurking in the background about to ruin the story. So before Rivergate Mall looked like it was struck by a nuclear warhead, they used to be a cool place to take your family in the Easter season. So we went to go take our family to have pictures with the Easter Bunny. So we came up with this really cool picture. It only costs like $47 or something. And there it is. This is not AI. This is really cool stuff. It used to happen in Rivergate Mall. Crazy. A little Tennessee history. So we take the photo. Andrea's going to get it ready. This is back in the day where you have to take the picture of the picture to post the picture on social media because it had happened if it didn't get on social media. And is anyone going to know that we're good parents if we don't show the world that we did this? So we have the picture, but then sometime a few moments later, I was doing something really responsible. I was actually playing a video game. I remember exactly where I was sitting on the coffee table to do so. And Kate comes ripping around the corner. That's our oldest. And she says, "Daddy, I noticed something in the picture." What do you notice in the picture other than you and this ginormous bunny? And if you zoom in a little closer, you can notice there's a face popping out of the Easter Bunny's mouth there. So now I'm conflicted. There's two options here. One is He ate them, all right? So you better be good, girl, or hard conversation. So we opted for hard conversation, and this completely ruined the photo. So as picturesque as Eden is, there's this little creep in the background that's looking to ruin creation, and this is Satan, and he brings a stain called sin. And he brings this thing called sin, and it ruins the story. In this story, we can understand how it's ruined through the guise of three garments. We see that things are broken first because Adam and Eve have on fig leaves. Fig leaves mean that they are now ashamed of themselves. They are covering themselves. And I'd like to point out to you, in the ancient understanding of shame, it did not come from religion. It came from the inside out. So you can actually run away from religion, but shame is awfully loud. Still. And then from fig leaves, then God comes, kills an animal, clothes them in a loincloth. So that's the second garment, loincloths. And what this means in the story is creation that was unstained, where there's no loss, there's no death, and everything is well, is now stained by blood. And then third, a veil. So Adam and Eve get busy running away from God, noticing that the distance between God and man because of sin was chosen by man and woman first. And then they head on out of the garden. God puts up a wall. More on that next week in that series. And now there's distance. Three stains marking the garments of all people from all places born into it. Shame, loss, and distance. Cornelius Plantinga Jr. says, sin disrupts something good and harmonious. In sum, shalom is God's design for creation and redemption. Sin is vandalism of shalom. So the idea that Jesus came on earth to deal with all these sinners is not all the way to the mark. Jesus came to earth to restore shalom, and in doing so, dealing with sin, because sin is what disrupts shalom. This is the biblical understanding of sin. Not that there's a list of do's and don'ts made by an authoritarian God, but there's a list of life and death, and these things lead to life, and these things lead to death, and life more abundantly leads to shalom for all people of all nations, of all colors and all stripes. And this was his vision, but the creeper was in the background staring through the garden, waiting to bring shame into the world, distance into the world, and loss into the world, and we've been trying to rub out its stain ever since then. But aren't we resurrection people who have experienced a resurrection? Let me take you to another important memory in my life, okay? It's on January 8th, 2000. Here in the Mid-State, we call this the Music City Miracle, but how they call this the rest of the globe, they call this the last time the Titans were good at football. Okay, so now at this juncture of my life, I am a Titans fan. I gave up on the Titans because they're not good, and I went to where my heart ultimately was, and that was the Green Bay Packers. I share that not to poke fun at anybody in the room, but as another evidence that Jesus must be alive, because this guy with the mic will give up on something if it's gone, all right? But if I don't believe in him, I'm not celebrating it. So this play happened, and all of the Mid-State finally was proud of something other than Trace Atkins, and we were able to celebrate, and it was incredible. And the next day, a seventh grade lunch table, sitting across from Quentin, I made an unthinkable mistake when I said, well, I was at the game. I wasn't at the game. I was sitting at home watching it on the shared TV in our one bedroom home with my three other siblings and my mom and dad. But I said I was at the miracle play, but the truth was I've never experienced a miracle. And I wish that someone would liberate me from this lie. I'm just doing it right now. This is confession. I'll pay you for therapy when this is over. You can take your tithe back, I guess. And then ultimately, I wanted to be delivered from it. And I want to deliver you from the lie. Is your life marked by a stain? And you say you know resurrected Jesus, but he said he takes stains away. So why am I having to hide this and act like it doesn't hurt? To get to the real resurrected Christ, you're going to have to be honest. When did you first see the stain of sin and feel shame spread through your soul? I can tell you my earliest memory is when a friend found his dad's magazine stash. And I felt shame because I knew I wasn't supposed to, but I was also ashamed because I wanted to. When did you see the stain of loss in your life? Mine was when my granddad died. My granddad was the first time I'd ever experienced loss where I thought, this guy is ultimately good. Why is he not here now? Who's going to pick me up in my mind? Who's going to pick me up from school when I'm sick now? When did you see the loss when you realize you weren't as close to God as maybe you hoped so, or maybe you hoped he would be. Mine was when I was a youth pastor of a really large youth group. I went 2 years without reading my Bible or praying for me. To write my sermon, of course. But to know God, no shot. And this is where the resurrection story on the path forces us to start, in the garden. Do you have the honesty to make this admission? The world is broken. And you have to admit you're also broken, causing the brokenness. G.K. Chesterton was asked by a newspaper publication to write about what's wrong with the world. For those who are unfamiliar, newspapers are papers. You fold them, and that's how you would get the news. So honestly, it was a little easier back then. I would like to go back. So he wrote this article, and they were expecting a masterpiece from this brilliant mind, and this is what the article said. To answer the problem of what's wrong with the world, dear sir, I am. That was it. So do you have the courage to admit that you are part of the brokenness? That's stop one on the journey to resurrected Christ. Now, to the grave we go. Mary is on her journey. There's two really important Marys on Scripture. If you were in a Catholic church, we'd be majoring on another one today. That's the mom, but today you're not. And we're majoring on the second one, and that's Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene, we don't know a lot about her. Some people say she was the woman caught in adultery. Problem is, the Bible doesn't say that. And then some people think she was the one who washed Jesus' feet. And then all of these different spaces. So there's this one thing we know for certain about Mary. Luke 8:2. Think about this, if this was the detail about your life that was in the Bible. Jesus cast out 7 demons out of her. Wow, I was hoping for a spot in the story, but I don't know that I'd want you to share that about me. So we don't know how she got there, but I don't think that you're wrestling with 7 demons if your biggest problem in life was I cuss when I stub my toe. So something's going on in her, and she is lost, and this is what's so remarkable about the Christian story. The Christian story is not about fixing broken people. It's about restoring the dignity of people who have had it ripped away from them through life and decisions, who have been abused and been manipulated by the wiles of sin. And yet, this is the woman who is headlining Resurrection Sunday. There was a cast of characters that the God of the cosmos could have picked from. And he said, where's Mary? I love that woman. Let her be the one to ring in the resurrection. Where is Mary? Now, this would have been stunning to this first century audience, because in the first century, the culture showed no love to women. Women were not allowed to be a disciple of a rabbi. Women were not allowed to be a part of just normal public life like men were. And yet, here's Jesus making his proclamation to her. What is he trying to tell us? One historian named Celsus said, the reason I could never believe in Christianity is because God would never reveal himself to a woman. That's not Christianity. That's the culture, by the way. And yet Jesus chooses to reveal. So what's he saying to us? Here we are in 2026. You are welcome in the story of Jesus. With your doubts, you are welcome in the story of Jesus. With your questions, you are welcome in the story of Jesus. You are welcome in the story of Jesus. With your habitual sins, you are welcome into the story of Jesus with oppression. You're welcome into the story. Everybody's cast into the story. Those who are wrestling with religious shame are welcome into the story. Those whose marriage is falling apart are welcome in the story. Those who have it all together are doing financially well but can't seem to figure out why life is not the way they thought it would be are welcomed into the story. It's a strange cast of characters in this movie. In fact, Hollywood would kick it out, but thankfully, Hollywood wasn't writing this script because Mary got in this story. Now, Mary represents what a secular world believes about Christianity. Oh, that's sweet. This little dimple, this lady found hope. Whatever you need to get by. Karl Marx called Christianity the opium of the people. Whatever you need is sweet. I'm happy for you. You found your thing, Mary. Congratulations. It was getting strange to be around you, to be honest with you. The 7 voices thing was always crazy, and we're just happy that you figured this out. But Mary's not trying to run away from reality. People don't come to Jesus to be medicated from reality. People come to Jesus to face it. I've got to deal with these demons. Are you the one? I've got to deal with these thoughts. Are you the one? I've got to deal with this craziness inside of me. Are you the one? I've got to deal with all of this oppression. Are you the one? I mean, gosh, the story's talking about death. We're not running from reality. We're running right into reality. He let the movie end without a pleasant ending. He sent them home on Good Friday with tears and no end credits scene. He's diving right into reality in the text. With all due respect, this book is not running from reality. The culture's running from reality. Cultural escapism looks something like this. It's a cycle. How do we handle shame in our culture? We ignore it and try and outperform it. Shame's voice is loud, but if my performance is better, it'll silence shame. So if I can get my body in the right type of shape, then maybe the shame about something that happened a few years ago will go away. If I can get enough money in my bank account, then I won't hear what my father called me when I was younger. If I can get enough likes on Instagram, if I can get up the ladder and get to the corner, whatever it is, if I can get up the ladder. A lot of people preach so that they can silence shame, trying to fill father wounds behind pulpits, trying to figure out how do we just not address it. And then secondly, what does the culture say to do with this sense of loss? Deny its existence. Never think about death. Wake up every morning and commit yourself to never think about that this all ends. And what does the culture say to do with distance between God? There is no distance between you and God. You just got to make your own shalom. Make your home a safe space. Your world carefully curated like it's its own Eden. This is why we lose our minds when crazy things like pandemics happen. You remember 2020 still fresh? Yeah, it's fresh. So it's fresh. So we got to get, and we're like, oh man, we're trapped in our home. We're going crazy. Because this Eden is fake. And it's the reason we can't ever be quiet for too long, because if we're quiet for too long, we'll know that there is no peace here. So I want to ask you today to also reject magic Christianity. I'm not a fan. I was going to say, hey, but that's strong for Easter. I'm not a fan for magic Christianity. It's say a prayer, do Christian things, and hope it works. It's just that easy. It's like magic. Everything goes away. Until it doesn't, all right? So it's like, I did the thing. I did Christian things. I started listening to the edited versions of secular music. I did the Christian things. I don't say bad words. I say dag nabbit now. Like, I did the things, and I'm just going to hope it works. Church, there is no resurrection power in this. This may be effective at keeping you in church, but I don't want you to stay in church. I want you to know Jesus Christ and follow him with other people in this thing called the church. This is not a pyramid scheme today. This is a heart level cry to say we need something real. And if this story is real, and if this resurrection is the real thing, there is a better story that's available. So reject it. There is more to Christianity, and it comes from a life embracing, following Jesus. Ask for it. Go for it. Do not settle. Demand that this faith live up to the lofty aspirations of our rabbi, to abide with him, not to have a prayer closet, to know him in his word, not to attend another study, to be a part of the Great Commission, not to help me build my empire. Demand it. To be a part of a family of faith. Man, you don't realize, I'm going to get off on a tangent because the time's not a big deal. That, like, the power of that is right here. It's like, I'm demanding this. Why would we settle for a little bit of reassurance, a little bit of freedom, and a little bit of hope when resurrection is what this story says you have? But why do most people settle? That grave. The grave is the point on the journey where the stain of loss is so bright. Something does not go according to plan. The garden is now a long memory. In this text, Jesus is dead. Her rabbi's gone. In the mind of Mary, Jesus is dead. This rabbi is gone. And her life is a lie. What was it like to be in the mind of Mary at 11:08 on Easter morning? You think she had a pretty dress on? You think she was saying, I knew it. You psyched me. I knew you were never dead. Where's the angel? Sing Firm Foundation. Let's celebrate. I knew it all along. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. What do you think she was? I don't know what's true. I'm not sure what to believe. He was a good man. Why is he dead? Why are the Pharisees still getting to run their little Ponzi scheme down the road? Where are these disciples? I'm here by myself. I thought we were in this till the end. This is the power of loss. The stain of loss tempts us to question what we believe and forces us to reconsider what we knew, and that's the healthy way to deal with loss. I'm questioning what I believe because I didn't believe that death was part of this story, Jesus. And I'm reconsidering what I thought. But there's a danger there. To not be tempted to reconsider what you believe, but to be convinced that you must reconsider what you believe. That's the only logical response. It's the I'm at a loss moment. It's God, how can I have infertility? I'm at a loss. God, that guy said that red blood makes it white. Why won't this sin leave me? Why do I think about it in the middle of the night? I'm at a loss. I read the importance of the church, but God, when I look around at these people who are taking advantage of others and spending other people's money who don't have it, and they're building their empire, I'm at a loss. Like, I know that you're dedicated to these people, but I'm just at a loss right now. I don't know what to make of this. And if this is your body, why are they treating people this way? And I'm at a loss because if you're king, why do pandemics happen? And I'm at a loss because you said you hear prayers, and man, we beat the door of heaven for that person, and they're not here right now. I'm at a loss with this, and this is where the grave, and everyone faces the grave, and you won't even just face it one time. I was staring down at the grave a couple of months ago, just like, gosh, man, I'm at a loss. What's wrong with me, God? What's going on with me right now? I faced it in 2020, and it had nothing to do with this pandemic. I'm at a loss right now. What is going on? Because then loss becomes unconfessed pain, and unconfessed pain becomes like a sediment that settles in the heart. And notice that Mary, the tomb is empty. She should have went back and said, he did it. But she can't. Because the power of the stain of loss, it blinds us that good news could ever happen. And I'm sorry if someone ever told you, well, you're going to have to get past that. It's really easy for a guy on a mic to tell you how to process difficulty. It's really hard to do it at coffee. And I think that's why in this text it's important that you see Jesus saying, dry it up, woman. The story is good. Have faith. Faith over fear. Put on a t-shirt. Print that. It's going to get big. He comes close. He comforts her. Because he understands that the stain of loss is emotionally complex. Mary is mourning. She's afraid. She's got to be a little angry. It's also mentally overwhelming. I had this plan and it's gone now. Now, here's what I love about Mary, and here's why I love the Bible. Because you would think that the way we celebrate Easter, which I love the way we celebrate Easter, that the way that like Mary came out there and was like, I know it's about to be so good. I mean, just get ready. It's about to be the day of days. And that she's waking up, right, and they're all matching, the disciples are, and they're getting ready to post up next to the tomb and hit one of these to Satan and say, send that to hell, and tell them, here we are now. We got after it this Easter morning. That's not how she looks. This painting is what it looked like. That is what faith looks like. Mary teaches us that great faith doesn't always look great. It doesn't look like, look at me believing in the goodness of God. Rawr, sing the song again. It looks like, I don't understand, but I'm still here. I don't get it. I got more questions than answers, but everything that I saw before this moment, I believe was true. I don't know what to do with what's happened now, and I don't know what it means for the future, but this is what great faith looks like. This painting is the ability to say, I will remain. And not just remain gritting your teeth, wiping your tears away, but to say, I will stay near Jesus. That's her only aspiration when she's confused. How do I cling to Jesus right now? And if he's dead in a grave, I will go to the grave right now because I need answers, because he meant too much to me back here for me just to move on right now. I need to know, can you cling to Jesus? I mean, some of the most heroic people you ever meet are sitting in these seats. There's a remarkable woman in our church who suffered a remarkable loss last year, suffered another one recently, and she just finds a way to get near Jesus. And you would never know it. She says, can I just lay on this? So here's a church. We think being near Jesus, it means things like, we think to be a disciple of Jesus is four things. To abide, which means learn to pray and be with God. To belong, commit to a church family and get to tables. Spoiler alert, the goal is not that you would just do this every Sunday. The goal is that you would do this Sunday so that you can meet the person next to you so you could go to a table and really walk this faith out together. There's a limitation to what I'm doing right now. Reflect. Help me understand the scriptures. Blaine teaches a class. Incredible. Gifted teacher. And fulfill. Figure out your God-given purpose. Can you cling to him when there seems to be nothing to cling to? Because we're going to learn in a few verses at the end of the journey, he's lurking. To the gathering we go. So Mary sees this news. She doesn't know what to do with it. I'm an introvert. You know what I would have done? Never went back. I would have been like, I'm just going to go be by myself. I don't know how to process what I just saw. But in wisdom, she goes back to the gathering of who? Other disciples who are wrestling with the same things. Not superheroes, just people, just normal people who are wrestling with the complexities of loss. The stain has bore its weight on them as well. I think Satan, which here at this church we still believe that he exists, he would have you go in isolation and answer the questions by yourself. But you're never by yourself. You know this, right? All of these thoughts and lies and cultural, you're never by yourself. So she goes back to trusted brothers. People whose life she's seen lived out. She doesn't spend the podcast on how to deal with loss according to faith. A review of the book of Job. She goes to her brothers, other people wrestling. So in boxing, they have corner people. These are people in the corner, you know, they help bandage you up, send you back out there, and then they could throw in the towel for you. But boxing originally started out with no gloves. No, if you've heard this recently, people seem to be a little tougher back in the day. All right, so they're boxing without gloves. And here's what the corner people did. So get ready to have your mind blown at how much tougher they were. Here's what the corner people could do. Come pick you up and walk you back to the middle so you could keep fighting. You know what I would tell the corner people? If you're at the place where you're picking me up, grab my feet and take them that way because I don't want any more. All right, I don't want any more. So these men, they would come and they would put your arm around them and say, all right, you got to get back in this game. Like, you need corner people. You need a corner people. And I know it's like, well, I have my friends. You need a lot of corner people because sometimes our needs expand even beyond our friends. And you need a diverse family of people. So I want to be so honest with you. I want to see you come back next week, not because I think you need to hear from me, okay? I think sitting under God's word and listening to these incredible guys, I think it's fantastic. But I think you need corner people. And we have the best corner people that you could meet. You don't need a me. You don't just need an it. You need an us. So I'm begging you to put to death live recorded podcast Christianity where I am a stranger who is trying to fight this fight on my own. Like I am compelled, like something tangent. There's something special going on here. And I want to tell you what it is. There is one full-time paid person here, and you're looking at them, and you're like, you're the guy getting compensated for what you're doing with all this other beauty around us right now. And so, yeah, this is me. And here's why I say that. Because the best part of our church is all around you right now. They give their time. They're accountants, and some of them are nurses. Some of them teach music lessons. Some of them record, and they do film. And some of them are healthcare professionals, and some of them are in between jobs, and some of them have miscarriages, and some of them have wrestled with faith and suffered unmitigated loss. And I'm telling you, you get a few disciples in a gathering around you, and there's something special about it. You need a gathering. We leave the gathering and have the courage to go back to the grave. She brings two brothers, Peter and John. Jesus has left a divine signature in the grave. In John 11, a brother by the name of Lazarus dies. Jesus comes up to the grave, says, Lazarus, he sheds a couple tears. Lazarus, come out. He comes out. Take his dead clothes off, because it would be awkward to be alive and be mummified. And so take these things off of him. And Lazarus is just out here just living his best life in Jerusalem again. A calling card is left. Jesus has left clues as to what's happening. I want to tell you, church, there is evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is not some myth cleverly devised. In verse 5, when Peter walks up to the grave, it says he saw the grave clothes. The word for that is blepo. Say blepo. You guys are now, learning a language. This is crazy. We're going to put the language department of Sumner County Schools out of work, Dan. And so, blepo, this just means you're looking. You just see it. He looks in there. It looks like no one's in there. Thank you, Peter. And then it says in verse 6 that he looks again. This is the word for theorero, which where we get our word, he makes a theory. Now he's not just looking, he's thinking about it. See, here is the giant misconception about Christianity. It's been alleged against this marvelous rabbi that in order to believe in Christianity, you just have to feel and believe. But this text says, oh, no, no, no. You have to slow down and contemplate. Look at the evidence. You've got to explain how 12 men who were terrified become 11 men who are willing to die for this. You've got to figure out how to explain how the most notorious death that ever happened doesn't have a holy site now. They got holy sites for brothers that weren't that great, in my opinion. But here's Jesus, won't give a list right now, but here's Jesus, the most notorious man to ever live. You want to know how you end a movement? You go show him where the body was. There he is. There's your risen guy. He's right there. Well, what if they stole the body? There was a folded linen. You think anyone's ever been robbing a house and said, guys, before you get out of here, man, make the bed at least. Like, you guys are terrible people. Like, we're going to rob this house, but we're not animals. I mean, fold their laundry before you leave at least. If you're going to rob their jewelry, fold their towels, all right? Save them in a couple of hours with insurance. Like that's not what happens. E.P. Sanders, who is not a Christian, not a believer, a historian, says the Jesus followers, and later Paul, had resurrection experiences, in my judgment, a fact. What the reality was that gave rise to the experiences, I do not know. And most historians arrive at the idea who don't believe, maybe they were hallucinating. Well, that takes a lot of faith to believe too. There was another Messiah figure that came after Jesus, Simon Bar Kokhba. He had a huge following. You want to know how they ended it? They killed him. You want to know why I didn't keep going? Because he stayed dead. I don't know that anyone's gathering today wearing pastels saying we're here to celebrate the resurrection of Simon Bar Kokhba, because the way you end the movement is you cut off the head. But it's hard to cut off the head of someone you can't trace down because he's resurrected. There's evidence for the resurrection. There's also a new story being told. If the first story, maybe we've talked about a lot of garments the last few days. On Palm Sunday, they were throwing jackets on the ground, an act of submission. On Maundy Thursday, Jesus gets out a towel and he begins washing the feet of disciples. On Friday, a veil tears. A king's robe is stripped off of his body. And now, fig leaves, loincloths, veils. Jesus says, how about a new story? Because if the story in the last garden was shame, loss, and distance, three stains, what if we could make them new again? And he tells it through three new garments, torn veil. The symbol of separation, the veil in the temple, torn from top to bottom. Distance became, or unrestrained access to God became distance. And when the veil torn, distance became intimacy again. You're as close to God as you want to be today because of what Jesus has done. You know, the scriptures never said there would be peace in this life like we're promised in the next. But he offers us the Prince of Peace, Jesus. He says you can know him in the chaos of this life. The veil's torn. What about these fig leaves and shame? Oh, there's a new garment. It's the folded linen cloth around his face. Who before leaves a grave folds clothes? We struggle to fold them in our house. And we're not as busy as a resurrected Messiah. It's almost like a methodical plan has taken place. And he said, you know what? Let's fold them. That's my opinion. Let's show them. In case he didn't hear me on the cross, it is finished. It is finished. The proverbial garment might drop. Shame placed with I see you, I know you, and I love you. And then the final garment, it's them burial clothes. They're just on the ground. But where are they? In the grave. So loss replaced with promise. One day, burial clothes stay in graves. This is why Frederick Buechner would go on to say, resurrection means that the worst thing is never the last thing. But of all the parts in this text that get me excited, when he resurrected Lazarus, he hits him with this. Someone's got to unwrap this guy. Come on, man. Get your jaws off the ground. Let's come on. We can't do two resurrections a day. He'll suffocate. So get the things off of him. Well, who unwraps Jesus? I don't know. It wasn't a person. And here's what it means for your soul. You can contribute nothing to finishing this story. However it happened, it was the Father, Son, and Spirit, start to finish, making right what's been done wrong, stains being made new. Whatever happened in that grave, we'll never know on this side of life. But I know it didn't involve Daniel helping him in any way. It is finished. And when I say it is finished, I didn't say I am finished because there's anything else for you to do. I'm letting you know it, whatever it was, is finished. And what is it? It is loss, distance, shame, washed white. How do you wash something white that stained hundreds of years of civilization? You got to use blood is what the riddle was the whole time. And only the blood of a spotless lamb. And I don't need you to unwrap me. I don't need you to add to your salvation. I don't need you to add to what I'm doing. I just need you to look, get a theory for what happened, and let that theory be what it is. And it's, oh my gosh, the rumor's true. He did it. Red blood has made us white. Now that's where it should end, right? But we go back to the garden. Mary stays at the tomb. I love Mary because she's not okay with magic Christianity. I don't think Peter and John were either. I don't mean to like shame and hate on those guys. They did pretty good for themselves in this faith, I would say. But Mary stays. How do you announce a resurrection? What is the PR marketing for that? I mean, I can't go anywhere without seeing the Titans' new logo, and it's not that big of a deal. The marketing, though, is incredible. They've done a fantastic job. Who do you call to say, hey, I'm going to do a resurrection down the road? The angels are planning. Do we want to do lights? No, we did that for, like, the birth. Do we want to, like, have a preacher? No, we definitely don't want that to happen. What do we want to do? What do you want? What do you want? You want a cool theatrical video to lead into? Like, what do you want? Where's Mary? Huh? You want to individually see a formerly demon-possessed woman to announce that you're here. I've never heard it said so good. Thank you for repeating this back to me. What does this mean about our faith? Oh, I think it's simple. If you want new life, you have to seek Jesus and be known by him. Tim Keller says it's better than I could ever aspire towards. The essence of Christianity is personal pronouns. If you are here this morning saying the Son of God was born, he died, he was raised, he ascended, and he's coming again, that doesn't make you Christian. But if you say the Son of God was born for me, he died for me, he was raised for me, he ascended to the right hand of the Father for me, and he's going to come again for me, that's the essence of Christianity. When did Mary experience the resurrection? It wasn't when Mary said, Jesus. It was when Jesus said, Mary. It became real. There's no need to lie. Mary doesn't have to make up a false truth. It's just real. So you say, Daniel, I want to walk this journey, and you made it sound simple. I get it. Oh, clever G's, grave, you know, garden, grave, gathering, grave, garden. But that's just, I mean, what are you even talking about? How do I walk the journey? Mary showed us in the text. Honest prayer. What's her prayer on Resurrection Sunday? Where have you laid them? Just show me, because this all feels like a lie right now. Just an honest prayer. Where have you laid him? If he's there, and if he's real, and if this resurrection's true. See, here's the thing today, man. I'm not trying to get you to make a quick decision and baptize you next Sunday. I'm trying to get you on an honest pursuit right now. If you are unsure if Jesus is real, then pray the prayers. You got to at least check it out. Because if it's true, you can't just not check it out. Like, I mean, gosh, what's the word? If it's you, I'll try this clean thing. And if it's you, like, I want to know, is this real, this honest? The Easter story is very clear. God has a place in the story for honest, difficult pursuit. So you don't have to straighten your tie, get everything right, and say, he's right, great sermon, he got me, he's alive. No, I want you to have the real thing. Not magic, I'm not a magician. And that's why I think a liturgy that we have done for hundreds of years needs one addition to it. Put it on the screen for me, Justin. Christ is risen. Christ is risen indeed for me. Can you stand? It's time to put a big old bow on Holy Week. Can I show you an image? Lewis Miller is a florist in New York City. He didn't do these flowers. Say I do, D-E-W did. Because our church represent. So, Lewis Miller's a florist in New York City, and he's a world-renowned florist. He makes so much money off of what he does, but in his free time, he goes wherever there's trash in New York City, and he puts flowers there. He does something beautiful where people just walk by and say, this is gross, this is disgusting, and that is what resurrection looks like. Jesus said, I see Daniel, and everyone's walking by him. No one even notices him, but I see him, and I'm going to go plant something beautiful in his life. I see Mary. Everyone was walking by him, but there she is. I see her. And then he went and did something beautiful, because what I think is marvelous about this text is all while she was wondering where he was just lurking in the background saying, oh, when she makes eye contact with me, everything is going to change for her on that day. And she'll notice floral life springing up in all of these different places. And she was never the same, because she went from garden to grave, to gathering, to grave, to garden. So one final time before Holy Week sets us out, the words of this say, hallelujah, what a Savior. Hallelujah, what a friend. Hallelujah, King forever. We thank you for the cross.